Hello, and welcome to the Act Natural podcast. I am one of your hosts, Anthony Farrigo.
And I'm Nick Thaven.
And today, we are joined by our two lovely guests.
Kurt Telsrow.
And Stephen Knight.
Very nice to have you guys on. Thank you for coming.
Glad we could be.
Yeah.
Why don't you go ahead and give a little introduction about your guys.
Introduce thine self.
Yeah. Whoever wants to start.
Kurt, introduce yourself.
Okay, I'll go. I've been acting for about like the last 5 years in Cleveland. I did a lot, you know, when I was young, which was a long time ago, and got back into it. Most of my training is really for film and TV, but, you know, hopefully at some point maybe move into some stage work because I think it would just be fun. But been doing this, working with a lot of people, and, you know, exciting community.
Hell yeah.
And I guess I've been messing around with film since I was in, I think, fifth grade.
Okay.
It was just in the before times, it was just me, my friends. One of them got a really, for the time, upscale VHS camera, and we're just like, let's make some movies.
Yeah.
Oh my God. They are so not fun to watch.
Oh.
But we did that all throughout grade school, high school.
Mm-hmm.
And then I had some life stuff happen. We'll get into that later. And I had to stop acting for a good few years to get myself together. When I was like 20, 21, I started trying to take it seriously again, doing like a bunch of indie auditions, tanking those. Got onto a few sets, realized I needed way more work, and I discovered Hood School of Acting. Started taking some classes there. It's where I met Kurt.
Mm-hmm.
I was going to say, if my memory serves me right, you both actually did go to the same school for acting.
I've known Steven probably for 5 years now.
Just about, yeah.
Yeah.
You guys did a film somewhat recently, The Mimics, the title.
Yeah.
Where you play, I think you shared two scenes, if I'm not mistaken.
Yeah, we do.
Yeah.
One was really short. I almost forgot that one happened.
Which one? I can't remember.
There's the...
I know The Steps, The Office, and then the final.
Two.
Yeah.
Oh, there's
three,
the final
three.
One. There are
yeah,
three.
Yeah. I mean, it was fun because, you know, like we understand how to have the relationship with each other, which is super important. And I think... especially the office scene. I think that worked really well.
Yeah, no, that day, I saw Kurt on the call sheet, but I'm like, Kurt's a common name. There's no way it's him. I see him walking up. The joy I got, because I'm like, oh my God, I get to just go ham with someone that I already have the comfortability with to bounce off of.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
I hadn't gotten that experience of a surprise guest that I've worked with before. On the set, so it was really cool.
It's actually amazing, like people that have like that level of training, you know, you can just bounce off them. You're it's like you're safe already, you know. We were, you know, that office scene, I think we were like really pissed off at each other, and we should have been, you know. But I mean, at the end of the day, we're gonna walk out and it's gonna be just fine.
Yeah.
But you know, if somebody doesn't have that training, it's sometimes hard to you know, connect with them in that way.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, with Steven, it just happens.
Oh, you're too kind.
No, you're very, very full when you come in. So it makes a difference because I'm reacting to real emotion.
Yeah, I've been told before on sets that I need a warning label that just says, warning, I'm a lot.
It's good to be a lot.
Yeah.
It is.
It gives you a lot to work with.
No, it does. It does. And I think anybody that's doing acting will know that. And anybody that's probably, you know, doing a lot of stuff behind the camera will appreciate that, you know, when that happens, that extra level. You know, it's not that working with other people is impossible. It's just like you know it when you feel it.
Mm-hmm. It's funny. You should have somebody on set that just like follows you around with sunglasses and be like, don't talk to Mr. Knight. Yeah, don't talk to Mr. Telsrow.
Know who he is.
Yeah.
My client's not taking questions right now.
He's a lawyer.
I got a little fun question for y'all. What's the best food you've ever had on the set?
Catered.
Do you want to go first, or do you want me to take it? I think
you
I have
can
my
take
answer.
A second to think about your answer.
Man, I'm trying to think.
Well, the fortunately or unfortunately, there is only one answer for me because
really?
There's only one. Like, so a lot of the college films, the student films, mm-hmm. the low budget productions.
Yep.
It's a what place can we get a whole bunch of food cheap? So I got called up by my agent a couple years ago for a lottery commercial, and I was just a featured background.
Mm-hmm.
I guess the person they had dropped or they didn't have enough people submit.
Yep.
And since that was an official like network television production,
yeah.
They had fully catered. You got to like it.
Nice.
It's very simple. If you ever gone to a wedding, you know how you
yeah.
mark down what you
yeah.
want on there? Same thing. So like I had right. essentially wedding catered food during the break.
Nice.
I think for me, you know, no specific. I do remember when we did the one Powerball
yeah.
and
yeah.
the those crumble cookies. I mean, I don't know, man. I've just got this thing about sweets, and literally, it was like I think the most shocking thing was watching Rachel eat as many of those as I did, and she's like a third of my size. You know,
yeah,
it's
yeah.
like
crumble. Crumble's got some. They got some good stuff. That was actually that wasn't even us. That was just the house that we were filming in. They like
yeah.
They just had them for us on that day.
Oh, okay.
Super
well,
nice.
I'll tell you what, man. I loved them.
I would say, yeah, for some context for the audience, Powerball is me and Nick's film that we made last year.
Last spring, yeah.
Oh, it's a film. I thought, like, Powerball Lottery. I was like, oh, okay, cool. So you guys already
Well,
know.
It's about lottery, but it's like a narrative. It's like a 6-7 minute
So, yeah,
drama.
It was all filmed at my my best friend's house back home. And so his parents were, like, really kind in giving us mm-hmm. Some food while we were filming.
Yeah,
mainly in the form of caramel cookies.
It was an hour drive, because it's in Avon, so
doxed.
It says it on the lottery ticket.
Yeah,
but Steve Livingston is the lead on that.
Steve Livingston is that?
Yeah, that's
is that the guy
sweet.
That takes
bunkers.
Bunkers.
Yeah.
Oh,
yeah.
Yeah. No, okay. I was thinking of someone else.
Yeah.
I did not get his last name. Last name. Thank you.
Yeah, Livingston. Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. Steve and I worked together. That was second time. And
yeah.
Because
your first time was Crooks.
Yes. 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 Mm-hmm. And yeah, he's exceptional. I think Powerball. I could. Yeah. It was father son all day. It definitely was. It worked really well. I'm not sure his training, but
yeah.
But he's absolutely fantastic to work mm-hmm. with. And
so then, hey, Kurt, then I got a question for you. Since you're a bit of a older gentleman, not to call out your age like
old
that,
man.
yeah. Do you usually, when you're auditioning for films, do you usually get typecasted as a father figure or?
It depends. So. I think one of the good things that I did, and there was a film, I'm trying to remember the name I did last year where I was like this crazy guy, Mr. Hoff.
Spirit of Radio.
Spirit of Radio. There you go.
They
Madison
filmed in
Shook.
This room, for one. One of the scenes.
And yeah, I was absolutely like this crazy guy, and it was so much fun to be like something different, because it is true people want to be like the lawyer, the
mm-hmm.
you know, when I had my hair shorter, you know, it's like okay, the you know, older military guy, mm-hmm. I did something like that before, detective obviously,
yeah.
you know, Crooks and what we were talking about Banana Man that
yeah.
is not out yet, you know. So yeah, you get typecast, but every once in a while somebody will be like, man, why don't you try this?
Mm-hmm.
And I don't remember if I even auditioned for that at first. Maybe I got more than one audition. She's like, try this one.
Mm.
And Madison was like, oh, I really like that. And that it was fun because,
yeah.
it, you know, you don't have to be the same thing, because you're right, people want you to be like, you know, teacher, lawyer. I mean, it's your typecast. It's not a bad thing.
No.
You have to know your type in this industry, but
mm-hmm.
But then there are people out there that seem to be able to break that And if you can break it, why not?
Yeah.
You know, it opens new doors. I mean, well, why do I have to be like the uptight guy all the time? That's, you know, like, I mean, I can be something different, right?
Yeah. Yeah.
Well, I mean, right along with that, like Steve Livingston, he played the lead in Bunkers, right?
Yeah.
He was whatever that character's name was.
Emmett.
Thank you. He is a bigger guy. Like, he looks like he could play a linebacker. He's got the face and hair of Chris Evans in Not Another Teen Movie. Seeing that suddenly play this anxious, sheltered mess was insane.
Yeah.
So, like, like you said, seeing people that can go from what their type is to something so far out of what they should is insane.
Yeah. I mean, I see that in you a lot. You tend to stay with comedy. But I have seen you flip, and when you do serious stuff, like, I know, like, especially the last year or two, it's like really come out so much stronger, like amazingly strong. And
you're too kind.
No, I mean, it just shows. No, it shows the growth that that I can visibly see. Like, you come out and you do something completely different. And it's believable, it's true, it's real, it's you. And, you know, so maybe comedy is where you might get typecast, but that doesn't mean that that's the end of the road if somebody gives you a chance to, like, try something else, right?
Yeah, that's fair.
Yeah. You both were recently on the set Revolt. Not at the same time, but...
No.
Yeah.
You were the chef, and you are a police officer, I think.
No, so, those are two different ones.
Okay.
I play two different police officers. Neither of them in Revolt. In Revolt, I play a dance choreographer.
Oh, that's right.
Mm.
Which is a very just their role.
Yeah.
There's nothing really about it other than he has an existential crisis.
Have you danced before? Do you do dance?
Okay.
Do you tango?
I know, like, the basic step of salsa, but other than that, I got my... In that break where I wasn't acting, according to other people, I'm very pretty. And I took care of my body there for long enough that I look good without clothes on, so I can do adult stage work.
I see.
I am very good with a floor-to-ceiling cylindrical metal object, if you know what I'm talking about. So other than that, I know basically moving hips with rhythm. That's it. I'm not trained.
Yeah.
Which is lucky. I don't have to dance as the dance choreographer.
You just have to choreograph.
Exactly.
Or act as a choreographer. Choreographer.
Yes.
Yeah. When it comes to being typecast, or I should say, like, doing roles, do you feel like there are, kind of like what Kurt said, are there roles that you wish you were maybe more, like, you wish you could do more, or like that you haven't done, like maybe something more, like, more dramatic, or maybe more, like, kind of out there, like, experimental?
So I have longer hair. Me and Kurt have similar length hair, but you wear it completely differently than me.
Yeah.
So I've been getting typecast a lot lately as druggie or drug dealer. I was literally just on a set where I got called at 6 p.m. the night before because they had the guy drop and was like, hey, you look like you smoke weed. Can you come be, high on set? I'm like, sure, I've never smoked before, but why not?
Yeah.
So the hair is doing me a lot and simultaneously no favors.
Interesting.
I would love to be able to play those more dramatic roles because the training that we've gotten, like you said, seen, has allowed me to go to those places. A lot of my life experiences allowed me to go to those places, but the lead, the Brad Pitt type, I think I'm kind of screwing myself out of that.
I mean, you had that recently with Mimics, the title. You were the
That was great, and luckily it was a dramatic story about a wrestler, and wrestlers have the crazier hair, so it works. It's like I'm not going to have the opportunity to play a lot of them, but there's going to be a couple that no one else is, like, it's my wheelhouse. Mm-hmm. No one else has a chance.
Yeah.
For those, it's worth it.
Awesome. Anthony.
I hope that made sense.
No, that made sense.
Steven, I also have another question for you.
Yes.
When I was doing my research on you, You were on a series called Public Access 3000.
Yeah.
No, you're gonna have to forgive me because I didn't watch the full episode.
That's fine.
But you play a what I interpret as a knockoff Goku character.
That's exactly what it was.
And you get brutally murdered. But yeah. can you like explain like what Public Access 3000 is?
Okay, so
and then maybe afterwards like your experience on the set too.
Yeah. That was probably one of the surprisingly better productions I've been on for how low budget it looked.
Okay.
Mm.
So the idea behind this local sketch comedy group that, as far as the Cleveland area is concerned, are, at least in my opinion, one of the best out there.
Okay.
Mm-hmm.
And for the past like 5-10 years, I guess it'd be 10 years at this point, they had this series going called Public Access. And it was about these robots in the future mm-hmm. using really bad, like late night Adult Swim, low budget production style
mm-hmm.
shows to corrupt the minds of the American post-apocalyptic public.
Okay. public access.
Yeah.
Like AXIS, right?
Yeah. So it's the, you know, it's the axis of the public.
I see, yeah.
But along with it being public. It,
play on
it's,
words.
It's a fun little thing, but their idea,
double
they
entendre.
Were... They, it wasn't just they were trying their best and it looked bad. No, their goal was to make it look professionally unprofessional. Mm-hmm. They wanted to emulate that concept. Yeah. In one of the ideas.
Because I kind of got a bit of a video game high school vibe when I was watching it. I don't know if you've ever seen that series on YouTube.
No, I haven't.
Okay.
I need to.
You're alone. I haven't seen it.
I'm so sorry.
Well, no, it's okay. Well, my roommates forced me to watch it.
Okay.
Less.
There's three seasons. It's Freddie Wong, Rocket Jump, the that whole kind
okay.
of
all right.
kinda, scene. Okay, yeah. I would watch it because it kind of had the same vibe to me as Public Access.
It's fair enough. Yeah, one of the ideas was... you know, doing the standard Dragon Ball Z parody.
Mm-hmm.
And they, I was friends with them for some reason. They posted about it on their page. Hey, do we have anyone that has a Goku style cosplay? I'm like, boy, do I. I have a good one and I have a bad one. Which one do you want? Oh, the worse the better.
Yeah.
So they came in, they painted me up. I got to be Goku. I was already a cosplayer, so it mm-hmm. worked out. Yeah. Again, it's one of those, I'm not going to be there for every role. There's going to be one that comes along once every few months that
yeah.
no one else
yeah.
has the ability to play.
And that's you said that was a Cleveland sketch comedy group?
Yeah. God, don't shoot me for not knowing the name of them.
Okay.
That's okay.
But
we don't have any apparatus with which to shoot you with, so.
Oh, good.
Mm-hmm. If I had one of those pens on me that I could build into a little gun, you'd be toast.
Yeah, no, and actually the real finishing up on that. So yeah. Public Access 3000 was like their wrap up one. All of the ones before that culminated into this. They had a full blown campaign for it. And then when they finished it, the showing of it was itself another like layer of it. So what they did is no one besides them knew. They booked a venue, and then when people were going there, you'd get to the door and they'd go, are you here for the wedding or the movie? And they staged a fake wedding to be taking place in the venue double booked. And okay. So halfway through the movie, they had to stop and do a wedding for this fake couple.
That's so funny.
And to really throw people off, they said, oh, by the way, if you're in the front couple rows, it's a splash zone. Please put on your ponchos. They never came into play. It was just they wanted to throw people
oh
off
my
as
God.
Much as possible. And then they had a wrestling group come in and said that, you know, originally they were supposed to be a wrestling group. But they failed. And then one of them... came in and tried to suplex either the bride or the crew. This it was better than the movie itself. That's why I'm like, these guys embody the sketch comedy better than anyone I've seen lately.
Yeah, that's like performance art right there.
Exactly.
That's crazy.
It is great. That I am so glad to have helped brought that to life.
Yeah.
You guys do the acting classes together, right?
Yes.
What is that group called?
It's the Hood School of Acting.
Yeah.
Hood School of Acting.
Yeah.
Spelled HOUDE.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. How is it? Do they teach a specific method of acting or like what is
Meisner?
Sorry.
Meisner.
Yeah. So it's, I mean, it's all about listening and responding. That's really it. Mm-hmm. You know, you start out, what is it like repetition and then, you know, repetition with the point of view and then you work into, you know, relationships and scenarios and, you know, it's a long process, but I mean, it helps you to, you know, to build like all the things you need. So when you're a character, like, you know, Steven and I are working together and I'm the boss and he's the employee, essentially, you should be able to tell that.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we shouldn't, I mean, yeah, I don't know. Maybe some people underestimate the importance of the relationship, but I mean, in Meisner, it's very important that, like, you establish that.
To the point where you do not get to lines until you've mastered every other aspect of it, because the words don't matter at the end of the day. It's the meaning behind the words and the relationship. Mm-hmm. Ideally, when you're watching something, you should be able to tell within the first 3 seconds of how they're interacting, who they are, what they're doing, what's going on.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Now, I would imagine this changes if the script is bad.
It really shouldn't. It shouldn't matter. You should still have the relationship. If the direction, if somebody wants to do your job for you, like, to an extent that's ridiculous, then, yeah, it could come out, you know, not correct.
Mm.
Okay? But I think most people in this industry, we all work collaboratively. So, I mean, if we were doing a relationship and maybe the dialogue was off, but we were still saying it to each other in the way that was like, okay, we're, you know, father, son, or, you know, business associates, whatever it is, it's still going to work.
You're captivated just by their interaction. It doesn't matter if they're talking about tangerines at that point or if, like, it's clunky. The script being bad, the lines being clunky can affect it a little bit, but at the end of the day, you can be gripped solely off of a performance.
Mm-hmm.
Doesn't matter what they're talking about.
See, you mentioned a director doing your job for you. I want to pull on that thread.
I want to hear about this.
Do you have experiences where you feel like the director doesn't trust that you can get their vision through, or?
I worked with somebody that literally wanted to tell you how to do every aspect of the thing.
Like, down to, like, the inflection?
Oh, everything. I think you should sit back in the chair. I think you should do this. You should, and it was like the worst thing I ever saw in my life. I'm like, okay, well, yeah, I knew it would be, but you know what? He was a control freak, and the guy I worked with, he's like, oh yeah, he had me go through every single, because they go to school, it was a student film, and they go to school together, and he's like, oh, he had me go through every single line and told me exactly how to say it and what to do, and you know, and a couple times, like, he had some moments where I was like, oh, that's good. And just caught, you know, it's like, come on, you know, like, it's building something together.
There's trust involved.
It's trust involved. And the director is there to tell you, like, when you need to do something different.
Mm-hmm.
But to try something. And it's usually something weird in direction. It's not always that specific. And just, you know, it's something kind of, you know, it's just like, oh, try this and see what happens. And it's not always, like, down to the T. Like, you know, people think that they're going to be like, be a little more angry. No, it's probably not going to be that. It's going to be, you know, well, I wanted to try. I think you told me one time something about a roller coaster. It was the most bizarre direction I ever had. And it was literally like a roller coaster, and you're going up and you're going down, but then you're going sideways. And I'm like, I remember looking at you and being like, okay. And then when I did whatever I did, you're like, that's exactly it.
Yeah.
Okay, so that's what I'm talking about. Mm-hmm. It's a level of trust.
I got a question for you, just real quick with this. I'm taking your role.
Yeah.
So what do you think would be worse? A director who is super particular at overanalyzing everything you're doing and controlling every breath you take, or someone who doesn't care at all, only focused on how the shot and the framing looks?
We have that question.
We have that exact
question. Oh, my God.
Here, ask it.
No.
That was great.
No, I mean,
answer.
It's both. Worse? Both are worse.
If you had to pick. Which one would be easier for, to produce a better product? Not even easier for you to work with. What's going to be better on the screen?
Oh, I still think the person that's going to be more concerned with your framing, and at least
the control freak.
No, the person saying, you know, like, you're saying the framing is more.
They're only focused on the shot.
The one only focused on the shot is.
I'm not
going to
name any local directors because there's one in particular that I'm thinking of, but we'll go big because I'm only punching up. M. Night Shyamalan does not care at all about his acting. Watch his movies in black and white with Wu-Tang on. They are great music videos. Like, turn the sound off on the movie,
Dark Side
put
of the
some
moon.
Music on. Amazing. The shots from that man are great.
Yeah, yeah.
He doesn't care about the acting.
Interesting.
Yeah, so. that would be, yeah, I mean, I think I've actually been on one like that, too. And it is actually on Tubi, and I don't take credit for it because it was probably the worst thing I was ever on. This guy was totally insane. I spent like a whole week, like 9 days, out of town every day. Mm-hmm. And he was nuts. He was like, he would blow up at people. He would get, and freak out. He started, I signed a contract, said I wouldn't be an extra. He cut out all the scenes I had, anything with dialogue. So, I've got credit. I could take credit, but I just don't, So I'm like, I make sure I don't do that on my IMDb because I do not want credit for this thing. It looked terrible. He had found footage in some of it, and they were not the same speed if you watch the movie.
Found footage or like stock footage?
It was like stock footage, okay, I guess. I don't know. It was.
I think it found footage like Blair Witch, like it's like shaky cam.
Okay, all right. So, I mean, but it was.
So probably, it's probably stock footage.
Yeah.
Stock footage.
So everyone's going to run into somebody here and there like that.
Yeah.
But that's only been two, and I've done quite a bit. And so, yeah, you're going to run into some people, and you learn who you don't want to work with, right?
Mm-hmm.
So.
Yeah. Live and learn.
Live and learn.
I want to ask, because. Because I know that, Steven, that you have worked on some stuff that's on Amazon Prime Video.
Yes.
Before we get into, like, that specific aspect of it, like,
sure.
What, have you guys noticed, like, the differences in, like, working on a, like, a student film or, like, a really, like, low-budget thing versus, like, an actual, like, professional set and, like, the environment of everything?
Yeah, no, there's definitely a difference, and sometimes it can be a good thing. So, like, one of the easiest experiences on set I've ever had was probably the lowest, like, production crew.
Yeah.
They had three guys and one camera.
Okay.
It was the fastest, best thought out shoot I've ever been on. We did the entire thing in 2 days, only redoing shots once or twice.
Wow.
Because they already knew what they were doing, and the guy had the control of the camera entirely in his hands.
Mm.
But everything above that, up until it's full professional level,
yeah,
they're figuring it out as they go a lot of the time, mm-hmm. and that can get draining. I see why stand-ins are such a valuable role on set.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And then once you jump up into the, like, the full-blown, I'm going to touch on this real quick, just because it's on Amazon Prime does not mean that it was a fully professional production. You can put anything on there.
Yeah.
You just have to give up the rights for it.
Mm. Gotcha.
It's the same thing with Tubi.
Mm.
So the ones that you've seen on there, they're higher level, but I'd still say it's the local Cleveland scene. It's still people kind of figuring it out as they go,
mm-hmm.
which they were fun. They're a little bit less controlled, so you get to do a little bit more that you wouldn't get to do on a very controlled professional set.
Mm-hmm.
It's a give and take. ironically, I think the most professional one I was on was that lottery commercial.
They had the most money to make out of it, probably.
The lottery, yeah.
Yeah.
What about
you,
Kurt?
I don't know. My experience has been pretty much depending on the people I'm working with.
Mm-hmm.
I met a couple of people along the way that have referred me to a lot of other people. And, and I think working with those people, the people that know people is more important to me.
Oh, yeah.
Because I have, like, they're in the same vein.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. They work, they know each other. When somebody says, oh, yeah, hey, can you do this? And they're like, yeah, I know you worked with this person. And you're like, oh, okay. So a lot of times I get that.
Just back to trust.
it goes back to trust. And then I always have a good experience with that, you know. I think one of those on there, I think I sent you, where I was like the smoker.
The Blue Man?
No, the other one, the where I was like the...
Oh, Crux.
No.
No.
Signal to Noise? Signal to Noise.
Signal to Noise,
sorry,
yeah.
I'm getting my...
And it had been like a couple of years since I worked with this one guy, Tommy, and Phil reached out to me and he's like, hey, can you do this? And he's like, he goes, I heard you're like really into kind of David Lynch type films. And I'm like, oh yeah, I love David Lynch. And he's like, well, I got one for you. And it was a very unusual, because usually I don't do a character like that, but it was very much reaction and, you know, and just, yeah, it had to have a lot of moments in it and a very slow pace like David Lynch does, but it was very interesting. It was a great experience, you know, and, you know, so again, that was a, you know, just a random referral. And And, you know, somebody reaching out, send me an email, hey, I got your name from, and I'm like, okay, yeah.
I mean, what is it? It's like networking is 81.26% arbitrary amount of the industry, right?
Yeah.
So it's like, you know, it's like you're in one of the arcades and you're playing what I like to call child gambling machines, where it's that you're throwing the coins up trying to get the stack to the corner.
And if you just put one more coin in, the stack's going to fall over.
So that's what you're doing. You keep throwing out these coins, and one of them... it's going to fall at the right moment and come back to you.
Hopefully
and,
there's an earthquake. So
Yeah, hopefully, you know, everyone in the production drops out and they're like, I guess we have to go with this guy.
It is all networking.
That's so much.
I mean, I think over the long term, when you look, the same people work with the same people over and over and over.
Just look at Adam Sandler's team.
They have benefactors, you know. It's the same thing. It goes beyond actors, too. It's like we're taking a scoring class right now about music production. And you know, there's directors that have composers that they work with over and over again.
Absolutely.
In the same way. There's people that work with the same editors, same writers.
Same, you know, casting directors over and over. Mm-hmm. It's all, you know, it's all together because they learn to trust each other and it works. And, you know, that's why it's important, just, you know, like if you're going to do this, be part of the community and easy to work with.
Yeah. That's actually, it's funny because that's how pretty much everybody coming on this podcast is because me or Anthony worked with them on another thing already.
Yeah.
Like, because I was adjacent to Crux and you were on Crux, and then we got you for Powerball and the podcast, and then Steven, I met Steven on Mimix the Title, and then and Anthony and then additionally worked with him on Bunkers very recently, and then the pot through that. I think there's like a really small amount of people that I actually haven't met already, or Anthony, or I have not met, that are doing the podcast. It's mostly just like, you know, the networking connections things, just like knowing a person already.
Yeah, that's how I feel. I mean, it's you're comfortable, you know what you're going to get, you know, you can trust the people, you know, that are, you know, referring you as well. I mean, you're automatically, you know, that, you know, they're not going to be a jerk to work with.
Yeah. Do you feel like do you ever feel like you have gotten, so back to the idea of directors, the idea of directors who maybe don't fully have their vision in mind, have you ever felt like you needed to salvage a bad script or role? Like, you're the one in front of the camera, you're the one with the script you maybe don't love, and it's like, it's kind of up to you, since you've already committed the time and everything and you're there, to, you feel like the responsibility of making it good has kind of solely rests on your shoulders at that point.
Yeah, there's been a few. Like, right along with that, honestly, one of the worst, like I said, I see why standees are so important, is because I won't name names. But
we don't name names.
There's one I was on recently. They didn't have a shot list. They said it's all up here.
It's all up here.
Oh,
God. They figured it out as they went. I wanted to scream. I wanted to scream so bad.
Yeah.
I feel you.
You need to not only have an idea, but you have to plan it out. And when you don't, it's miserable for everyone.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it working it's so much more work than you would think. The planning part, because it's so much scheduling and it's so much emails. So much email sending.
And paperwork.
And figuring out all the little details. Because it's one thing to be like, I have this idea for like a cool like short film. And then it's like, okay. So now like write it in Pages. And you know, create a shot list and find a location and talk to this person. And so if when you skip out on those ideas because you just want to get to the end as quick as possible, you can end up on a set where everyone hates you.
Yeah, filmmaking is 70% pre-production, 15 actual filmmaking, and then 15 post, I'd say.
Yeah, we were talking to actor people in the previous session about how sometimes the people running the film are more focused on the back end, like on the what it looks like on the camera and how everyone on the set is doing, people who they know a lot better, and so as a result, the actors kind of might feel a little bit disconnected from the rest of the set as a result. Do you feel like you've had that experience? Where you feel kind of separate from the rest of everyone else working on it as an actor?
No, yeah, I'll just do a quick point and then throw it off to you. I'll ask, hey, how'd this look? And I will get a, like, they'll have a, oh, right, I should have been watching to see if you looked like you were in the moment.
Mm.
And they didn't care. Because mm-hmm. they're so focused on what's in frame, is the continuity there. They don't actually care about the emotion in it sometimes. I've been on a few.
I mean, I've been, you know, pretty lucky with the ones I like that
I just wish
haven't
more
had that.
Would give me notes.
Mm.
Hmm. Yeah.
Like, what was that good? Like, yeah, it was perfect. Don't you dare lie to me. I hated that take. What did I do wrong? Help me.
Other than one guy I talked about, you know, screaming and, you know, melting down and locations disappearing on the spot, and it, like, I was just unreal.
I need to, I'm gonna ask you after this what that guy's name was, because I have a hunch.
Oh, no, he's in Youngstown, so
I have a hunch.
Okay.
Oh, man,
we'll find out later.
Yeah.
But other than all the I've been lucky. I mean, I think, you know, even when I did the Blue Man, what was it, 2 weeks before that, the whole script had to change because the wife and daughter dropped out, couldn't do it anymore.
What?
And we had to literally rewrite.
You're talking about the people that were in the
oh
the photo.
My god,
they were in the photo. Yes. Okay. And
I did take a look at Blue Man.
Yeah. And so we literally had to do a film without a relationship in it, which is like, doesn't make it as strong. It's really difficult.
Yeah.
And they're like, you know what, we got it scheduled, we're going to rewrite it, and we're going to go. And, you know, that was the second in the series I did for them.
What is that series called, by the way?
It is
does it have
The Landlord, essentially.
The Landlord.
So it starts out with
The Landlord.
Because that's what the first step is called.
Yeah. And so we just actually did, when did I can't remember, it wasn't that long ago, that we just did the next one in the series. And I think writing wise, I think they pull it off.
Okay.
Doug, the writer director, he had to make a lot of changes to make this work,
mm-hmm.
you know, and then we had like 2 weeks to get it together, but we did it.
Mm-hmm.
It wasn't ideal, but,
made it work.
And, we just did another one. So, I don't know.
Cool.
It's good for me because it's been, I did the second, third, and now fourth. So, awesome. It's working for me.
I mean,
you know, and I do like working with these guys. I mean, something came up. It's a small production,
mm-hmm.
dropped out last minute. We talked about it. And it's like, okay, you know, if we put this off, it's going to be months. We got to get another one out there.
Yeah.
It's like, can we just rewrite it and go with it and try it? And
mm-hmm.
we'll do our best, see what happens, you know? And that's what we did. And I think action-wise, it was really good. We did some really good action. I think there was a lot of good in it, but the key to a lot of these films is really that relationship. And once that was taken out, is literally like one dude kind of like navigating through this little crazy, you know, world. Mm-hmm. And so it wasn't as strong as I feel it could have been, but that's nobody's fault because somebody dropped out and we just had to get on with it.
Yeah. This is something I see fairly often with productions, is people dropping last minute, specifically performers dropping last minute. And I wanted to ask,
who, I don't want to say not whose fault, but why, I feel like it's a common thing where actors might drop last minute. Is that a lack of communication with the production, or is it just being overbooked or very busy? It's a very broad question, and I'm not expecting you guys to be the liaison for actors all over the world, but what do you have any experiences where communication has been like shoddy or confusing, or like scheduling has been difficult to get nailed down?
Yeah. Or like something where you feel like it's probably best to not continue working on this production.
Oh yeah.
If you are comfortable talking about that.
Yeah. Of course. Do you have anything? Or
I mean, the one production where the guy was screaming and he's like, and if anybody doesn't want to be here, you should leave now. But you know what, man? I made the effing commitment. So I spent all 9 days doing that, yeah. Driving into Youngstown, driving into Pennsylvania, really long drive. I made the commitment. So I'm going to do it. That's just who I am. Mm-hmm. Okay. And I get it. Some people, there were people that actually left. Okay. I totally get it. You know, and I will say the people that stuck around just had the commitment because they're, you know, no matter how bad it is, you know what? People talk. Who knows who? We don't know. But
we don't know.
You know what? All I can say is they're not going to be like, well, Kurt didn't show up.
Yeah.
So, I like you said, it's a broad question.
It's a very broad question.
There's going to be multiple answers with it. Sometimes it is a better project came along for that particular actor. Mm. And
oh, that's understandable. We actually had that.
If one of them is an unpaid passion project and then one that pays comes along,
you take the paid one.
Yeah.
Dropping out in the middle of the production, I haven't been on a set yet that's had that happen. I'm trying to think what that would be. I feel like it would need to be, there's one of two possibilities. Mm-hmm. One, what Kurt was talking about. You were just being mistreated. You're like, you know what? I don't care. Mm-hmm. I think that happened in The Room is one of the most notable examples with Tommy Wiseau. Mm-hmm. Literally one of the characters either changes halfway through the set or just disappears. I think they change, if I remember right. They change actors halfway through the movie. Whoa. Because the person's like, I'm done. And if you know the backstory of that production, it makes sense. But if you're already on a production, you should be, as an actor, communicating with your agent or looking at your calendar, blocking out the days and going, hey, I'm on set these days, so they don't book you for that.
Right.
So really, unless it's a life-changing role, life-changing amount of money, anything
like
that.
Or just any amount of money if it goes from zero.
No, I mean, because even then, there's the integrity. There's, like we said, the industry is 82.26% networking, arbitrary amount. It's going to look bad, even to the people you're going to, if you're like, hey, I'm already on a production, they're like, well, ditch it. One, do you really want to work with someone that's going to make you sacrifice someone else's project?
Mm.
That says a lot about them. Or two, if you're willing to do that, that says a lot about you. Really, unless it's suddenly Marvel wants you for a really good speaking role, or you know, you're being mistreated. I can't think of a whole lot of other occurrences where you might go, no, halfway through, I'm done, reschedule.
Yeah. Mm. It could, yeah, just the, because there is that kind of rift between, especially with like younger, like student actors, like we work with, the rift between how much planning really does go in. Because, you know, sometimes it's just like you do the audition and then if you haven't worked on like a lot of sets or just a lot of productions at all, it can be hard to kind of realize how much work goes into the planning, and like we were talking about the planning and the pre-production, and at the same time, you know, when you're planning and doing all that stuff, it's hard to remember that you need to focus on the performer if you're like the director first and foremost, like the performer and the emotional like core of the story, and get wrapped up in like, well, how'd the shot look, or you know, how much time do we have left and stuff like that. Like that should be other people's jobs. So I think this can overlap.
So not having the appropriate jobs delegated out to enough crew can definitely lead into that, sounds like.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. Big time. Do you feel like, have you ever had like a really emotionally like
a really emotionally taxing role to the point where you've left set or stage or wherever, and it's kind of stuck with you in some way?
For me personally, and probably the same for you, thanks to the training that we've had with Meisner, we are able to drop most roles, no matter how taxing it are, mm-hmm. is, no matter how taxing it is, pretty much the second that you'll cut. Might nice. Be a little raw after that, but no, for at least for me, and I think for Kurt, yeah. our training saved us in that aspect. We're able to go home and just be,
yeah,
be fine.
So do you find it easy then to, when you're on set and you have this like this like really emotional scene, like kind of like leave yourself, so like you stop being Steven Knight and you stop being Kurt Tazewell and you are now that character of whatever, you know, the scene may be, and you are now this essentially new person in this moment?
Real quick, mm-hmm. just because I don't want to hog the mic.
No,
not exactly. For me, I coined this. This mm-hmm. is my first chance to actually put this out onto the internet.
Okay, let's go.
I describe acting as living vicariously through myself. I can't do otherworldly characters. I don't know how Johnny Depp is able to do that. I don't know who that man is. It's insane. I can only play me in different lives.
Mm-hmm.
So, no, in those moments, I am still me.
Yeah.
But the one thing, besides the repetition, besides the relationship that Meisner honed in, was imaginary circumstances. So you're creating this separate life that doesn't exist, that you're not attached to, so that when they call cut, you can drop it. That's what I was talking about when I said the training has saved us, essentially.
Yeah, it's separating yourself from, I mean, I know some people, they literally will show up on set already, they're in this character, and that's, you know.
Stanislavski.
That's great. I worked with a guy that, he works a lot, he's in Michigan, he does, oh my God, so much, it's insane, but he was, at this point in the film, blind, and I literally just, I was laughing to myself when somebody goes, man, I feel sorry for that blind guy over there, and I was like, oh my God, Dale pulled it off, this is great, you know?
Okay, that I one can't I can understand.
That. I can't do that.
That's a physicality. I would probably have to stay, like, blinders on for months, like Charlie Cox did, in order to keep those mannerisms up. That physicality is different. I'm not going to talk.
Well, I'll tell you,
I don't know anything about that.
He was totally always in the character. Like, unless like one of the actors talked to him, he would snap out for a minute to talk to you.
Oh, okay, cool.
But he would stay in that character like the whole time, unless there was something off topic that we wanted to talk about real quick. Like, you know, hey, you know, was that lunch okay for you? Oh, yeah, okay. He'd go right back to the character. And thankfully, with Meisner, we're trying to create an imaginary world. It's not that sometimes there aren't things going on in present day that couldn't move you that maybe you can substitute. And that's, you know, that's fair, too. Mm-hmm. You know, but spending all the time doing that, you know, use that for a boss relationship, right? And you got a crappy boss, man. And I had one not long ago, and it worked for me. And in a couple situations, you know, I switched jobs, you know, like back in the summer last year. So, but, you know, it's still something every once in a while. I've had certain things that I like, can recall that person, like, just want to punch you, you know?
Yeah, embody
actually,
them.
Actually, right. I think you gave me a better way to describe it. So, like, if you guys ever had something really bad happen in your day, but you're going to something, either seeing someone or doing something where you have to kind of put a mask on, right? Mm-hmm. And yeah. that other one, that really bad thing that happened, is still there, but you're trying to not portray it as much, so you almost create two separate emotions going on. That's actually how I might describe it, is when it's a really, really intense, you got to be prepared. The second they say action, you have to be bawling.
Yep.
You'll keep that in. That'll still be running in the background. And then if someone talks to you, you'll throw something up in front of it. You're almost reverse acting at that point. You're acting as yourself on set, but then you're in the character really under it.
Oh,
it flips.
That's it. That makes sense. I've never.
It's neither have I until just now.
Yeah, you're incepting it in a way.
Yeah.
Acting within acting.
Yeah, you're keeping the character, but then once in a while, you know, something in your personal life may be there, and it's useful because you're working through it. Mm-hmm. At that point, you're making a conscious choice. Like, you know, something just is in your mind and it's just like, boy, this makes more sense to use this right now and just work through it, because it will work you through it, you know, because you're going to be feeling real emotions and it just takes care of itself. But I wouldn't recommend, like, you know, reliving, you know, like bad events in your life over and over and over to do this. I mean, that's where Meisner comes in, and it's more helpful because, you know, people, you know, can get distressed doing it.
That was specifically Meisner's motivation for coming up with the method, is, or at least the imaginary circumstance, because he didn't want, one, the, you know, the memory to get stale, and then you're not able to use that. And also, you're not able to just have that memory be a part of you. You've ruined your own memory. But then two, if it's really bad, it may trigger you into like a full blown panic attack. One of, I don't know if you met her, her name's, not gonna name names. She's a very good friend of mine. Okay. Nothing bad about her, but she decided to use a very similar or exact moment that happened to her recently from a family member, and that sent her into a panic attack, and she had to stop going to classes for a bit, or at least stop using non-happy scenarios, because it wrecked her.
Ooh.
So Meisner was like, one, don't want it to become stale, and two, don't want people to be traumatizing themselves for roles.
Yeah.
So yeah, he worked that into the method.
Yeah, it totally makes sense. I mean, you know, if you think about, you know, my dog died. Well, the first time you're probably going to be really sad. And then after that, you're less sad. And pretty soon in 2 or 3 years, how sad are you?
You don't even care about the dog anymore.
Yeah, you've worked
through it. How dare you rob yourself of that attachment, that thing in your life that you love. Now you don't love it.
Yeah.
I mean, that's so bad to do.
Have you ever been recognized for a role? Now, ever has anyone ever been like, you're from XYZ?
Me personally, no, not yet. Nothing I've had is big enough. No one has seen any of this stuff. The only people that are looking up these movies or watching them is, it's being recommended by a friend who's already watched it. No, not as far as my acting have I been recognized. I've been recognized for other things by people I don't know, but not for films.
Gotcha.
Have you ever been on a different set, like within that bubble, and someone's like recognizing you from something else, or? I'm poking and prodding.
Yeah, no, I'm trying to think. Have you, Kurt?
You know what the odd thing is like, too many people know me for Crooks. It's over the top. It is just nuts. It is like,
really?
People will always, you know, there's, somebody even told me, they're like, I never watch it, but I've seen you in the hall. It plays in the hall sometimes.
It does.
And
it
I'm
does.
Like,
oh yeah,
it does.
And I'm like, wow, that is freaky. So, you know, like, yeah, I am very well known for that. And I am not ungrateful at all. That's just an awesome thing.
We have our, some of our student films play on the Kent State Television Station live stream in this building. All thanks to me, not gonna lie.
Thanks, Anthony.
Thinking about it, actually, there's been three.
Okay.
One was literally just on some of these more recent Kent State films. Mm. Someone asked, oh, wait, weren't you on Daddy Issues? I'm like, yeah, I was. glad you saw that. Hooray. Two would have been... one of my kids' teachers apparently knew me because they'd seen something in Cleveland that I was in. I have no idea what it was, but they're like, you know, my kid brought up my name, and then teacher looked me up, and Sharon was like, oh yeah, no, I know, I've seen him. Of course he's an actor. I know he's an actor. I can vouch for you.
That's awesome.
Yeah. I'm terrified to know what it was. the third one. This actually came into play. I almost didn't get a lead role in something I was in recently, Byte. Spelled BYTE. It's premiering in like April.
Yeah.
Because one of the first productions I was on, I played a naked zombie. And I just stayed in the nude on set for 8 hours.
8 hours?
It was in October, too. Oh, it was so cold.
Dude.
Yeah, wow.
Do they have, like, blankets or something to, like,
be warm? I didn't want to risk ruining the body paint and the autopsy stuff. Oh. So I was just... one of the money shots was a Florida head pan.
You were a nudesicle.
Yeah, it was not fun. But when I submitted for Bite, mm-hmm. the director went, wait, hold on. I reckon, isn't he the penis kid? And that was, again, first role, hadn't gotten any training, didn't know what acting was.
Yeah.
Since then, I'd gotten so much more. It's a night and day mm-hmm. change. But
Steven one of the, night and day.
Huh?
Steven Knight. Sorry.
That's good. One of the guys on the crew had worked with me before on something since then, and he went, no, this guy's great. Book him.
Awesome.
Let him audition. Let him come in. And they were like, oh my God, yeah. We almost, be careful about what roles you take, apparently, because they can come back to bite you.
Yeah.
Bite you.
You got that one. But yeah, I almost lost a role because I was recognized as the naked kid.
It's funny.
Damn.
Yeah.
Speaking of your last name, Knight, Anthony was wondering.
Hello. Yeah. So, because you mentioned a second ago that you were on Daddy Issues,
yes.
which is from 2019, and it's a KSU Independent Films. Film, which unfortunately no longer exists.
KSUIF, if you will.
Yeah, KSUIF no longer exists. RIP. But when I got to the end of it and I was looking at the credits, you were credited as Stephen Haas.
Yes.
So Stephen Knight is a screen name?
Kind of. It's a very convenient situation. So I've never liked my last name.
Okay.
It's a name from my step family.
Okay.
They have different interests that I didn't really like. I never really felt like I was welcomed. It's not like they shunned me, but just like, you know, they have a huge obsession with wine. I don't drink.
Okay.
When I said that I cosplayed, one of them came up and goes, so can you make any money at that? I'm like, wow, I don't fit in with this at all. So I've been trying to, for the past, like, 15 years, find a replacement last name to take as a stage name.
Mm.
Well, I 7 years ago met my now wife, and she also wanted to change her name because she's got this really elegant name, and it's three names.
Okay.
And then her last name is Leech. So you get you can imagine how much she was made fun of in grade school.
Yeah.
She's always wanted to change that. So we looked back through our family's like lineage,
uh-huh.
and a few generations ago, her actual family's last name was Knight, spelled K-N-I-G-H-T.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And there's a lot of history with that family in Akron. I'm like, Stephen Knight actually sounds really cool. Can we take that?
Yeah.
Like I don't know if you've noticed this, but a lot of actors, their stage names are a name, a simpler name, and then like an object of some kind. So Tom Cruise, Emma Stone, Vin Diesel, Nick Cage, Stephen Knight.
Mm. That's a good point.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So I was so excited to take that one.
Yeah.
So okay. It is now legally my name.
Okay.
So it's no stage name. It's just name.
Exactly, yeah.
Yeah.
But picked because it also really well as a stage name.
Huh.
That's really cool.
What is a Tells Row? Sorry.
Yeah. It's like, yeah, I think it's actually Russian, I think, in origin.
Mm.
I think it had a V. At the beginning, and then they ended up in Germany somehow.
Huh.
So yeah, I think they were from the area of White Russia, which is right on the border, and then they probably had to escape for some reason and go to Germany. And
for some,
it's that. I know my uncle did research, you know, years and years ago, you know, before Ancestry and all that.
Mm-hmm.
So, he had a lot of stuff on that. So it sounds like that's how the origin of that. And then all Tells Rows here, no matter how you spell it with the extra E or not, we're all related. It all started somewhere.
Yeah.
When they came over somewhere, some added an extra E in there. It was probably at Ellis Island. They sort of spelled it however they could. And,
yeah.
And that's the name that you got stuck with.
Gotcha.
Cool. Pretty neat. Pretty cool.
Well, you know, nowadays you don't really have to change your name.
Yeah.
So, like, I mean, I know at one time for sure, but you look at so many people out there now and they're just going by whatever they're comfortable with, whether it's a stage name or their real name. And so it gives you a little bit of freedom now. You don't have to, you know, change it if you don't want to.
I know people that go by their stage name for role related things, but they just go by a completely different name when, like, for unrelated acting things, yeah. Which is kind of cool. You can do that.
Yeah.
Before we wrap up here, I do want to ask, going back kind of to the idea of the auditioning process or getting picked for roles, do you feel like you have been picked for roles more because you auditioned for them proper and went through it, or because you knew they knew you from something else and brought you in because of that? Maybe you did audition, but it wasn't like through like a casting site. Let me rephrase the question. Casting site or just knew a person that knew a person? Which one gets you in the door more frequently?
In the door, getting the role or just...
Getting the chance to audition.
Casting sites. Mm. I've gotten more auditions through casting sites. I've gotten more roles through networking.
Okay.
But the actual like submitting out there, because there's 100 or so more just on Actors Access every day. I'm probably exaggerating, but you can just submit like crazy essentially.
Mm.
And at least for me, yeah, I've gotten a lot of auditions through that. But actual bookings, 82.26% of the industry is networking.
Yep.
Yeah, and bookings for me are all networking.
Nice.
It's like I totally gave up the other way. It's like if somebody doesn't know somebody after a couple of weird experiences, I'm like, you know what? I'm just going to do it this way. And, you know, like I've even, the last time I actually did, I think I talked about the one director that wanted to do all the directing for you. Mm-hmm. Okay, don't get me wrong. I heard Groucho Marx did that too.
Yeah.
He was a fantastic director. That's great. But you know what? He wasn't Groucho Marx. So I'm just going to tell you, like, now I'm more like, you know, I just need to just relax and be picky about it.
Mm-hmm.
You know, if somebody is like, oh, I know you from, you know, this or that, or somebody told me to contact you. Great. Okay. You know, now I'm glad with it. And if not, then, you know, I got to pass unless it's like some big, you know, professional production or my agent sends it to me, either one. You know, if I see it on, you know, Actors Access, like Steven said, or, you know, my agent. But other than that, yeah, I just want to go by referral because it's, I know who I'm working with. Then I can automatically jump in and feel like, oh, no matter what I do, it's not going to seem stupid. Even if somebody's like, oh, I totally hate the way you approach that, let's do it different, I know I'm going to be in good hands.
And from there, you can also meet more people and get referrals.
Exactly.
It's literally like when you're just starting out, you have to do auditions.
Yep.
Unless you have a crew that knows you already and they already had the production.
It's a privilege.
You got to be throwing those out. But the more you book off of those, the more people are knowing you. And then the more you're like, what is it? Your network of circles grows, and the more people are thinking about you at the right moment. Yeah, spheres of influence.
Although those spheres of influences were not good. Sorry, I'm a little history nerd over here.
Oh, different spheres.
Oh no, okay.
Not the 1800s spheres of influence. I don't. Anyway, sorry. I don't
mean. Wrong term. Then my bad.
Yeah. All right. Is there any last things you guys want to talk about? Comment, questions for us, whatever.
I would just say chill and be easy to work with. I mean, that's the number one key, man. If you are just gonna be uptight, whatever. We even hear the stories are in class, you know, about people that were like really big, and then, you know, Jessica Hood Morris is very good about giving a lot of insight into movies and what happens in the industry, and every once in a while we'll hear stories about people that were so difficult to work with, and guess what? They never work again.
That extends all the way into set work stuff too. There's a story a professor likes to tell of a guy who was a production assistant, an older production assistant, and he's super nice, and he's like, why isn't this guy like, you know, why hasn't he like made his way up? And when they started like actually like getting into it, he was like trying to tell everyone else what to do or give everyone else advice on other things because he didn't stay in it. Like he was hard to work with. That's what it came down to. Even though he was really good at, you know, the stuff he did, he just, people didn't like working with him. And I think it's a little bit of a scary thought that you can put all this work into the craft, but still could be judged by something else. But it's also, I it's a comforting thought knowing that there's something else is just being a decent person, you know?
Yeah.
So I think that's pretty cool, I think. People just want to work with people they like at the end of the day.
Mm-hmm. It's the way it should be, right?
Yeah, honestly.
I mean, you're building, you're building art. You're creating art.
Mm-hmm.
You know, there's no room for stabbing people in the back.
Mm-mm.
These things hang by a small thread all the time, no matter how big they are.
Yeah.
So, man, get on board. Like, work together. Because for God's sake, the minute you disrupt that, you cut the string and it's gone.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I want that quoted on a...
We'll put it on a basket. There's a guy dunking a basketball, and it says that, Kurt Telsrow.
Yeah, there we go.
Yeah.
Steven, any last minute?
Anything to plug?
Yeah.
To plug?
Any socials?
Hold on.
Oh, yeah.
Before you plug socials, did you have anything you wanted to say to finish off?
Any final words?
Yeah.
My brain right now is just going towards trying to give out advice to any people that might be listening to this. And it's best advice I got recently was from one of my agents before they were my agent. They essentially doing a class and they said, all right, who's coming up first? And I was the first one to raise my hand. I came up, we did it. And then he asked everyone, why do you think Steve got the job? And the answer ended up being because he said yes first. Because a lot of people, like the number of people that can do what you can do, not the way you can do it, but just are on the same level as you or higher, uncountable. So the best quality you can have, because you're all going to be able to, at the end of it, produce a good product, is just being there and being available. So just like an improv, see an opportunity, say yes.
Okay. Yes, and.
Yes, and what next?
All right, yes, now, and when's lunch?
You can go ahead now, plug your...
You go ahead first, Kurt.
If you want to.
I don't know. You know what? Go on YouTube, look up Reaper's Moon Productions. Those guys are doing good stuff, man. They make a very good quality product. I love what they came out with so far. The sound quality is amazing. You know, the... everything about it's amazing, and you know, start watching the series, see what happens. They're actually trying to get a script sold for a feature film, so that would be awesome. Doug actually was in California, Doug Turner. He was in LA for a number of years, and he came back because he, you know, has custody of his kids now, and so he's here in Ohio, but he has, you know, he's hoping to make a return at some point. So
exciting.
Go out there, check it out. You know, they, you know, there's a professional sound studio as well that they run. So,
oh, nice.
Yeah, a lot of good stuff.
Sweet.
And then if you want to find me, you can either Google my name, Stephen Nicholas Knight, STEPHEN, Knight spelled with a K, or that's my Instagram handle too.
Okay.
Stephen.Nicholas.Knight. I can find me pretty much
on
there. I'm always responsive. If for some reason you feel the urge to reach out.
All right.
Be in my movie. I have this idea. Oh. I have this idea for a movie. I think you should be a zombie. But, yeah.
Yeah, no, zombie butt.
Yeah.
There we go.
Naked. All right. Well, thank you so much for listening.
And thank you for joining us.
And thank you for joining us.
I am so glad we got to come on. Thank you so much
really
for having
appreciate
us.
Appreciate it.
Very exciting.
A lot of fun.
All right.
Yeah. And see you.
Follow us also on Instagram at @naturalpod.
That's where you can see us because you can only hear us right now.
Yeah.
So hear you later.
Bye.
Bye-bye.